will continue to make clear to Russia that further provocations will achieve nothing except to further isolate Russia and diminish its place in the world. The international community will continue to stand together to oppose any violations of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity. And continued Russian military intervention in Ukraine will only deepen Russia's diplomatic isolation and exact a greater toll on the Russian economy.
That's President Obama today reacting to yesterday's vote in Crimea to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. President Obama says he's targeting 11 Russians and Ukrainians with economic sanctions. Any assets they have in U.S. banks will be frozen. They won't be able to complete transactions in dollars, and other foreign banks are expected to follow suit. So will these sanctions make any difference to Russian President Vladimir Putin? And is there anything else the U.S. can or should do? Jonathan Broder is Defense and Foreign Policy Senior Editor at the Congressional Quarterly. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, first, tell us about the people the U.S. is targeting for these sanctions. Who are these 11 people, and will it actually make a difference?
Well, they are. Some of them are very, very close to Putin. They are his advisors. One of them is a guy named Vladislav Surkov. He's been one of Putin's advisors for a long time. Sergei Glazyev is an economist who's been advising Mr. Putin on Ukraine. Valentina Matvienko, I hope I pronounced that right, chairman of the Federation Council and the Upper House of Parliament. And Dmitry Rogozin is a deputy prime minister. I will note that no sanctions were placed on Putin himself. Mm. The government officials, the administration, in a phone call with reporters this morning, said that they don't want to get into sanctioning heads of state just yet. They're beginning with his advisors.
Just yet, meaning they're leaving the door open to do so later?
Well, they're leaving the door open to other sanctions, stiffer sanctions later. I don't know whether it would involve Putin, but they are. The president made it clear that more sanctions are on the way. If Putin doesn't back down from this military occupation and what looks like the annexation of Crimea.
Which doesn't look likely he will do, right, even if there are these sanctions?
No, it doesn't. I mean, Crimea, as your listeners probably well know by now, is very strategically important to Russia. The Black Sea Fleet is based there. The population of Crimea itself is largely Russian or Russian-speaking. So there are very deep historical language and cultural ties between Russia and Crimea.
So you raise a point, then, if there are these deep ties and the people of Crimea overwhelmingly voted to join Russia, what is wrong with that? What's the U.S. argument to say that they can't do that?
The U.S. argument against that is that the referendum was conducted under the gun sights of roughly 16,000 Russian troops who came in and occupied the Crimean Peninsula and took operational control over the whole region last week or about 10 days ago. So the idea that they would have a referendum under the gun, so to speak, makes it invalid. And the second reason is that it violates the Ukrainian constitution. So on those two counts, the Americans are saying that this is invalid and mm-hmm. no Western countries are going to recognize it.
Well, Russian President Putin points to Kosovo as a counterexample. Is that valid?
Yes, that raises difficulties for the administration because if you remember in Kosovo, the situation was exactly the opposite. The Russians were against Kosovo breaking away. And the United States was for it. So clearly, these sort of international issues depend on what is in the interest of each party at the time.
Mm. Well, the U.S. foreign policy toward Russia has been pretty frosty for a while now. Was there anything that President Obama and the administration could have done in the months, maybe the years prior to this, to prevent this from happening?
Well, I wouldn't say the United States could have done something. I think Europe could have done something. I mean, if you remember, this whole thing began in November when the then president of Ukraine was negotiating an economic rescue package with the European Union. and the consequences of Ukraine accepting that package would have meant that Ukraine would have drifted out of the Russian orbit into the European orbit, which is something that Russia is very, very, very sensitive to. If you know, the Russian history points to some very terrible things that came out of the West into Russia, the invasion of Napoleon in the 19th century and then Hitler's invasion in the 20th century. And millions of people died. So they're very, very, very sensitive to countries that are sort of on Russia's western border getting too close with the West. What could have happened and what didn't happen, and what is many Europeans are being criticized in Washington for, is that this rescue package was not done in coordination with Russia. Perhaps a better way to have gone about it would have been for the EU to contact Russia and say, let's both work out a package so that Ukraine feels it can get closer to both to Europe and still maintain its ties with Russia.
Well, that's providing the EU actually wanted those ties to remain strong with Russia.
Well, you know, when European officials are interviewed about this, some of them clearly acknowledge that they should have taken Russia's sentiments into account beforehand.
Jonathan Broder, Defense and Foreign Policy Senior Editor for Congressional Quarterly. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, it's Monday, and it's when we do our usual political roundup. And joining us this week is Josh Krauss-Haar. He is political editor at the National Journal. Hello.
Good morning.
Okay, so critics of the administration in Washington about Crimea and the president's foreign policy, there are lots on the Republican side, at least. And is this an important issue, though, to Americans? Are Americans following this, and will it play any role in the upcoming midterms?
Well, it's an important issue politically for President Obama because throughout his presidency, even when he was experiencing tough times, like in the run-up to the 2010 midterms or in his low points during the 2012 presidential election, he always had a strong approval from the public when it came to his handling of foreign policy, his dealing with crises overseas. And that's changed in a pretty big way over the last couple of months. You look at the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, his approval on foreign policy is now about eight or nine points underwater. You look at those numbers, they're very similar in other polls that are very reputable. And the one thing that the president can do with a Republican House and limited political leeway in a second term is to really take a lead on foreign policy. But the American public seems to be taking a very, very skeptical view of his handling of the crisis in Ukraine and also the problems that continue to go on in Syria and the civil war going on there.
And then the Republicans keep hammering him on Benghazi and Libya as well.
That's right, and that's going to play a major role in 2016 as much as it is in the upcoming midterms, just because Hillary Clinton looking like the early favorite to be the presidential frontrunner on the Democratic side, and that's something that she's going to have to account for.
Yeah. Well, so before that, the Democrats really are concerned about the 2014 midterms, and they, they've given up any idea of winning back the House, and now I think they're worried about if they can keep the Senate. And let's listen to White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs on Meet the Press yesterday.
There's real danger that the Democrats could suffer big losses because the real estate and the turf in which these elections are taking place begin with an advantage to the Republicans.
So what is the likelihood that the Democrats could lose the Senate come November?
It's at least 50-50, and probably given the latest polling numbers with President Obama's approval rating dropping and those results from a very pivotal, a special election last week in a swing Florida district where Republicans held onto a very competitive seat. The indications are that the environment is looking more and more favorable for Republicans. They already started with a very promising Senate map. The big battleground states that Democrats are defending in 2014 are in very conservative states like Louisiana, Arkansas, Alaska, Kentucky, and Georgia. Republicans are those are the only two states Republicans really have to worry about. So this is a map that's very, very conservative, a very favorable map for Republicans. When you add on top of that an environment that's trending in the Republican direction, it shapes up for the possibility of a very of not only a Republican majority in 2015, but the possibility of a wave election again.
What about Scott Brown deciding to run in New Hampshire, former Massachusetts senator?
He certainly puts that race in play, where Democrats without Scott Brown didn't have much of a chance. But his decision is indicative of a lot of Republican candidates who weren't likely to run in 2014 because they didn't think it was going to be a great year to run in competitive states like New Hampshire. You see folks like Cory Gardner, well-liked congressman from Colorado, deciding to jump into the Colorado Senate race against the popular senator Mark Udall. Ed Gillespie, the former Republican National Committee chairman, is challenging one of the most popular senators in the country in Virginia's Mark Warner. These are the decisions that Republican officeholders, the risks that Republican officeholders are taking because they see the polling data, they see the national environment is looking more and more favorable for the Republicans.
And what is it? Is it all about the Affordable Care Act?
Healthcare is a major driver of that intensity. I mean, you look at this Florida election that took place, and the Republicans and Democrats, the one thing that they agreed on is the fact that Republicans were showing up in record numbers because of their anger and dissatisfaction with the president's handling of health care. And it's not just Republicans. You look at independents viewing the law very favorably, and Democrats just not showing up. They're not excited about it, even if they view the law in a favorable manner. And, you know, you see what the president is doing, going on shows like the Zach Galifianakis.
Between Two Ferns. Yeah.
Because he's worried about the makeup of the people who are signing up for health care and the numbers of people signing up. So even the White House recognizes, even if they're not saying as much, that this is becoming a big political liability, and it could certainly shape the 2014 election.
Well, so why aren't they coming out, you know, guns blazing in support of the Affordable Care Act and trying to convince people that this is actually a good idea, getting people covered with health insurance and turning it around at all?
It's a very important question, and I was talking to a top Democratic strategist last week, and I was wondering why there's a district in South Florida where Republicans are attacking on the health care law. That was actually one of the districts, one of the parts of the country around Miami, where Democrats spent millions on Spanish language ads during the 2012 presidential election, touting all the benefits of the president's health care law. So I was asking why aren't we seeing these same types of messages in 2012 in a Democratic leaning seat, a Hispanic seat, one where people would seem to benefit from the law's provisions. And the strategist told me that even in a favorable environment, in a favorable district, people don't believe that this law is helping them. They you have to tell them you feel their pain before you can actually say all the positive things that they might expect to hear. So even people who would be predisposed to liking the law, where the law was once a little more popular perhaps in 2012, the numbers are so bad that even these types of districts are very, very tough to run on Obamacare.
Right, but they're also being buffeted by lots of advertisements, and the Republicans are far outspending the Democrats, at least so far.
Well, money follows the environment. The money that the Americans for Prosperity is spending is very, very significant, and they're reshaping the Senate races. They're putting more races in play because of their resources. But we saw in that Florida election, the candidate, Alex Sink, spent about four times as much money as the Republican candidate, and these outside dollars help even up the spending. And in the end, it was about on par. Both Republicans and Democrats spent about the same amount of money in total. And that's what we're seeing in these big Senate races that are emerging. You have Democratic incumbents that have a lot more money than their Republican challengers, but you're seeing this swarm of early outside money, most notably from the group Americans for Prosperity, that's really, really hammering the anti-Obamacare messaging.
Josh Krausauer, political editor at the National Journal, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, public radio producer David Weinberg finds fascinating stories in old cassette tapes. He says they are self-expression in their purest form. We'll find out what he's talking about and play some of his jewels next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. David Weinberg is a public radio reporter, and like all public radio reporters, he goes out into the world. He finds just the right people to talk to get just the right tape to create his stories. However, he's also fascinated by the vast archive of audio that's just out there, lying around in the world. Lost tape, forgotten tape, audio ephemera. It seems to be everywhere, and he finds it in basements, in thrift shops, and at garage sales. And so he started a podcast a couple of years ago called Random Tape. He joined me recently to share some of what he's found. And a warning, although we've bleeped everything objectionable in his tapes, the subject matter can still be a little bit edgy.
Hello.
Hello.
Acquired Beauty.
Hello.
Acquired hey. Beauty, can I help you?
My name is Inez LaPacola.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if I could get a hairstyle. You do bouffants or beehives, darling?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay, well, I want an appointment for tomorrow. Anytime would be good.
Okay, let me see. I have a 12 o'clock noon available. Do you want that?
12 noon? Oh, no, girl. I got to eat my roast beef sandwich. I can't come at noon. You got 1 o'clock?
No, I don't.
What's your next available appointment?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
David Weinberg, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks, man.
So what was that?
So as best as I've been able to figure out just from listening to the tape, it's these recordings that were made in a beauty school somewhere in Louisiana as like role-playing exercises where they would do these pretend scenarios and it would teach the people in the beauty school how to deal with things like customer service and things like that. But like I said, I don't really know for sure.
It did sound a little actor-y.
Yeah, it's actor-y, and the guy who's playing the customer, he's amazing in his recordings. Like the scenarios that he comes up with are just, they're insane. They're not scenarios that you would ever encounter in a beauty salon. There's one where he claims he came in to get a haircut and the hairdresser used rusty scissors and now he has gangrene and his fingers falling off. And like these poor girls have to like pretend like this is a real scenario that they would encounter.
I want to know what you're going to do because I need a lawyer.
But I don't think we need a lawyer for this. I think we can handle this.
What? Hello?
Yes.
I want to know what you're going to do. My finger swole.
Well, we're going to take care of this.
It's bleeding and it's oozing green. Now, she used rusty implements.
She did?
She did.
Could you tell me who performed on your hair?
It was Malina.
Malina?
Malina.
Could you hold on for a minute?
Sure.
Okay, so now it seems like they're just having fun. They're not really actually.
Yeah, it's just, and you can hear all this laughter in the background. Yeah. It's really nice.
Where did you get that?
To be honest, I don't know. I was going through a bunch of tapes that I'd collected from when I was living in New Orleans, and that was a tape that was in this box of stuff that I hadn't gone through yet, and it had no label on it. There was no label on it or anything.
So what was the first piece of audio that hooked you on this?
One of the first things I heard, I was like, this is amazing, and it sort of like opened me up to the idea that of these recordings that weren't meant for anyone. It's two answering machine messages, and I'm not going to set it up because I feel like they just sort of tell this story on their own.
I got your message today. I thank you for calling and returning my calls. You don't have to do all the apologizing and everything, Danny. You have to call me. And don't give me this about, oh, you're sleeping. I don't give a f***. You call me at midnight, 2 in the morning. I'll answer the phone, okay? You tell Tony if he answers the phone to wake me up. I want to talk to you. That means now, not next, not tomorrow, not next week, not next month. Now. So you call tonight when you get home. I don't give a fuck what time it is. I don't give a shit what you think. Call. I want to talk to you. Now it's not so important. You haven't called for so damn long. I've managed to find out the answers to my questions without you. So I barely need to talk to you, but I would like to. You're my son, and I love you. I thought you were graduating high school or college, not kindergarten. Call me tonight when you get home. Do you understand that? Good.
Okay, I think we get it.
Yeah, they actually cut him off. He continued to go on, but that's all the time that the machine would allow him to talk for. So,
first of all, people don't use voicemail as much as they used to, and they certainly don't leave long messages like that.
I think one of the things that stood out when I first heard that was like up until that point, I mean, even still today, like most of what I listen to is the radio, and it's stuff that's been crafted, you know, it's mm-hmm. edited, it's written, it's curated, it's stuff that, you know, has been put together in some way. And like this stuff is just so raw and so human in a way that I don't know, it just sucks me in every time I hear it. I could listen to that recording every day.
And so do you spend a lot of your free time going around to thrift stores and flea markets and the like looking for this sound?
Yeah, a fair amount. I mean, anytime I see a thrift store, I stop. And then there's one I go to fairly often, the St. Vincent's on my way home from work. I'll stop there. I was just there recently, got a bunch of tapes. But yeah, I mean, I poke around whenever I can.
And by tapes, you mean cassette tapes?
Yeah, these are all cassette tapes.
Well, so what is it about the cassette?
Well, oftentimes the best part of the, you know, finding a tape is like that first moment when you get it and you have to sort of figure out from the clues of the tape itself, like what it's going to be, whether it's like what's written on the label or the handwriting on the label. And so there's like this really, there's this tension built up in the moment, like right before you press play for the first time, where like you don't really know what it's going to be.
Okay, so let's hear another sample.
So this is sort of like the great thing about having a show now that I do where it's about found tape is that people that are that like listening to it are starting to send me stuff. And this was a tape that was sent to me by a woman named Logan Jaffe.
Can you feel it? Can you feel my face in your neck? Can you feel me kissing your eyes and your nose? Can you see that? Oh. I gotta tell you, I'll have prettier pictures in my head than I ever had before. And I thank you for those pictures. Real pretty pictures, Dougie. Wish the lights could have been on the whole time. Nice showers. Great showers. Could I change anything? If I would change anything, you would have had a beard and a mustache just for me to see, and then maybe you could have shaved it off. I would have loved to have seen that. I really would have loved to have seen that.
Oh, that's a nice. That's an audio love letter.
That's how it starts, but does not. The art, the story of that tape is like probably the, one of the best stories I've ever heard. So the way it sort of plays out is this woman fell in love with this guy, and she rents a car for him so he can come visit her, and he comes and visits her, and then he steals the car and doesn't come back. And so she sort of documents all this. But in those early recordings, it's like she's still, you can tell like she's still in, like in that right there, that she's still so in love with this guy even though he's stolen this car, and it just plays out in this really sort of intimate way, and she just goes back and forth between these like really like the way you just heard these sort of sentimental like remembrances of the time that they had together, and then if you want to play the next guy you can sort of see where it goes.
Okay.
Nice to hear from you again. What a you are. Not gonna talk to me anymore. You're not gonna talk to me anymore. And I'm pathetic. Begging. Please. You're gonna do it with my panties. Gonna throw them out? Send them back. I liked them. They were beautiful. Who knows when I'll wear them again. Why keep someone's panties if you're not gonna talk to them?
Do you feel a little bit like you're an audio voyeur?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, that's part of the appeal of all this is that, you know, you get led into a world that you weren't invited to. And that's, you know, that's something about tape that's so different. Like, that, I mean, that she made that tape with someone in mind specifically, and you can feel that. You can feel that this is a letter to someone else way more intensely than you can in, like, a written letter, I think. There's something about that voice being spoken to you, even though you know it's not written for you, that just it's just way more intimate.
You know, cassettes, they are a vanishing breed. Are you sad that they are a thing of the past? I mean, we won't be finding random MP3s around or, you know, the same thing. We won't have the physical manifestation of our outtakes for other people to discover.
I am sad that Because there is a certain kind of recording that gets made on a tape that I don't think is really getting made anymore. I guess the closest thing would be maybe YouTube, but not even that, because, like, you know, the recordings that people make for the internet are made intentionally to share. You know, like, people don't really make private recordings anymore. There's not really a medium for that in the way that the tape had always been, you know. It just, you know, like, most of these recordings were not meant for an audience. And I think we've kind of lost that in the digital era. It's like everything's for an audience, you know, whether it's your friends on Facebook or, you know, whether or not you're, like, hoping to go viral. That's the goal, I feel like, the implied goal in a lot of the things we make on our own now.
David Weinberg, public radio reporter, and check out his podcast, Random Tape, at randomtape.com or on iTunes. Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank you, Madeline. That's great.
Coming up, you probably felt that earthquake this morning. Lots of us did. And good thing it was small, but what if it wasn't? Is Los Angeles prepared? We'll talk with the city's earthquake czar coming up. First, let's get a news update with KCRW's Steve Chiotakis.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, walking into the office this morning, there weren't a lot of how was your weekend prompts. Everyone was like, did you feel it? And yeah, for the record, I felt it. It was a magnitude 4.4 earthquake that woke many of us awake at 6:25 this morning. Anytime an earthquake strikes, we ask the big questions about how prepared we are for the big one. Los Angeles recently took a step at addressing that question by hiring the first ever earthquake czar. She is geologist Lucy Jones, and she's been on the job since January. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Well, what have you been able to do so far since January?
Well, okay. So I'm actually not hired by the city of Los Angeles. The U.S. Geological Survey that I work for has entered a technical assistance agreement with the city and given them three quarters of my time. So I'm splitting my time between Pasadena and Los Angeles.
So in that three quarters, what have you been able to do?
In that three quarters, I have managed to gather a lot of information, and we've been able to, you know, flesh out the areas that we're looking at. There's sort of two big areas. One is about problem buildings. When an earthquake happens and we discover a bad type of building and we change the building code and stop that building from being built, it does not make the older ones disappear. And it's the retrofitting problem is what we refer to it. And we're looking specifically at the problems of the type of buildings like the Northridge Meadows apartment that killed a lot of people in 94 and the Olive View Hospital that killed a lot of people in 1971.
And these are concrete buildings.
Well, the Olive View is concrete. The Northridge Meadows is a wood frame building, but it's what we call soft first story. It's where the first floor doesn't have a lot of reinforcement and is a lot weaker than the upper floors. And then when you get the sideways push, in Southern California, it's mostly tucked under parking apartment buildings.
Mm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
So those are two types of buildings that are really a problem. They're going to kill people in the next earthquake. We know that. How do we find an approach that helps the city get rid of them and or retrofit them to be stronger during the earthquake?
And the LA Times recently pointed out that there are more than 1,000 buildings that need to be retrofitted.
Well, that's only the concrete buildings. And it's somewhere quite a bit, you know, it's on that order. The apartment buildings, there's probably more of them. It's a lot cheaper to do that retrofitting, and it's less disruptive. You can do it just on the first floor, so you're only disrupting the parking, not the place where people are living. But yes, it's a big problem, and it's not, I can't just say, oh, look it, those are bad buildings, get rid of them. You've got to find an approach that where we share the cost with the people who are sharing the benefits, which obviously is the owner, obviously are the tenants who aren't going to die in the earthquake, but also there's a lot of benefit to the neighbors and to the city to not have the blight of the really badly damaged building, to not have the overload on our healthcare system of all of those victims, to be able to use the roads instead of having rubble in them. So it is a shared problem. It's not the only shared problem, though. The other big area is in our infrastructure. So we need water to be able to go to work here, and we need communications. And what we're really looking at is how do we make the city able to function after the big earthquake? Look back in time. San Francisco in 1905 was a big, it was the city of the West Coast. It lost so much in 1906 in that earthquake that it was another 40 years before they got back to the economic activity level they had had before the event. So that's what we're trying to prevent. We don't want to have people abandoning Los Angeles and making this a place that nobody wants to live.
Now, I understand that San Francisco is actually engaging in a plan that is working to retrofit all their buildings, and they're spending billions of dollars to do that.
Right. They have developed something they call the Community Action Plan for Seismic Safety. And it's focused just on buildings. They aren't taking on the infrastructure issues that I was talking about. But we really do want to be able to share between the two cities. And they have a chief seismic safety officer, and I've been talking a lot with him, and we're looking at ways in which we can help each other find better ways to go about this.
So where is L.A. in the process? We have those 1,000-plus buildings identified. Are we still in an identification mode, or are we on to the next step?
That list is done by researchers for research purposes. It's not necessarily comprehensive. So I've got a year at the city. Here at the beginning, I am looking at gathering information and figuring out what are the pieces that need to be put together. And on the concrete building side, we need to be talking with the engineers who can define what makes a bad building and what makes an adequate retrofit. And it turns out those are pretty complicated questions on the concrete, much more so than on the software story. We need to work with the building department and then come up with a process by which we are going to identify the buildings and say this one has to be retrofitted and that one doesn't.
Well, help us understand if this morning's earthquake had been a lot stronger.
What likely would have happened?
Yeah. I mean, are we prepared at all?
We're prepared at all. We are. When you compare what happened back in 1933 or what happened in Haiti or Virginia, places, we are much better off than those sort of places. We have a lot of building codes in place. We probably won't kill very many people in a big earthquake here. Our building codes have been aimed at what we call life safety. Actually, our building code says if you build a building that's so weak that it's a complete loss after the earthquake, that was your financial choice to make, but you can't kill somebody in the process. So we are doing a pretty good job at that. We have these exceptions that obviously need to be dealt with. The problem is if we have all these badly damaged buildings, how do you go to work? And so we are looking at the picture in terms of the resiliency of our economic system. How do we keep it from not losing massive amounts of money because of all of the bankrupted businesses?
Okay, now, since I have you on the line, I want you to go over once again, I know you do this all the time, but what we should have in our earthquake kits.
Okay. Top of the line before anything else is water. However much water you're already storing, get some more. The second thing, and this isn't so much in a kit as at your home, is a fire extinguisher. Fire following earthquake could double the losses, and that's sort of the best case scenario. It's a huge, huge impact. You want to be able to communicate. So a solar or crank system to charge your cell phone is probably a really big deal. A flashlight, so when it immediately happens. Enough, if you take medications that your life really depends on, do you have enough of a supply that you can always go at least a week? First aid kit, obviously. For those of us who commute around the Los Angeles area, and especially for women who tend to wear shoes that you really don't want to walk a long ways in, keeping running shoes in your car is a really big deal.
What about cash? What about food?
Oh, thank you. Right. Cash is probably the most important thing because without electricity, we don't have ATMs, and they won't be able to take your credit cards. A few hundred dollars and 5 cents and 20s put away someplace very safe, obviously, could make a huge difference. Food, it depends on, if you already have a freezer with a certain amount of food in it and you lose electricity, guess what you're going to be eating?
Lucy Jones, earthquake czar for the city of Los Angeles, at least 3/4 of the time, and also a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Lucy, thank you.
Thank you.
Living on solid ground, not really part of the ethos here in Southern California. The big one is a constant guillotine hanging over our collective heads. And yet we keep building up and out an insatiable manifest destiny that is also very much part of our being here in Southern California. David Yulin is book critic for the Los Angeles Times, and he's author of the book, The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Predictions, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. Welcome, David.
Hey, Madeline, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. That is a great title. It really is. And so, because it really captures our cognitive dissonance that we have here in Los Angeles, right?
Well, that was what, I got interested in that project originally because I was interested in earthquake predictors. I've always been interested in kind of left field fringe thinker types. And I was really curious about people who claim to, by various means, psychic means or physical means or whatever, predict earthquakes. But I very quickly, in the course of my preliminary research, realized that I needed to learn something about geology. So I started talking to seismologists, and then the whole thing just exploded on me.
So to speak. Well, so how do you think, from a literary standpoint, how does the earthquake serve as metaphor for Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, I think like anything, I think of it as part of an entire sort of elemental landscape that we live in. So it ties into floods and fire and drought. And all. I mean, you know that old joke, right? Of course, Southern California has four seasons: earthquake, fire, flood, and drought.
Yeah.
So I think of it in this way, and that we have created, there is this myth of L.A. and Southern California as this sort of Edenic lotus eater type of place. But it's built on top of this incredibly harsh, unforgiving, and unstable natural landscape where we have a lot of seismic activity, we've got wildfire ecology, we've got all of these things. And I think the tension between those two things drives a lot of both the actual energy in the place, but also a lot of our kind of, our psychic space.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, also when you think of the drought and we keep watering our emerald green lawns and kind of hoping that it'll rain someday and yet knowing that maybe it won't.
Sure. Or rebuilding, right? Malibu is a fire ecology and it's going to burn periodically because that's what fire ecologies do. And then, as soon as it finishes burning, we rebuild right in the same place that burned with the full knowledge that at some point it's going to burn again.
Right. Exactly. Well, don't other cultures do that too? I mean, they live in hurricane areas or they live in places that are... dangerous. Yeah.
I mean, I think, life is an act of faith. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. You never know when someone's going to, come out of nowhere and hit you with their car when you're crossing a street or whether you're building, you just never know. I mean, in college, I used to read this guy, Velikovsky, who talks about meteors. And I always thought, you never know if a meteor is going to crash into your house. So just the act of going through your day. When I was researching that book, I talked to a disaster specialist for LA County, sort of what you were talking to Lucy about, what do you do to prepare? And mm-hmm. he went me through the list and gave me everything. And then he said, and then my advice is to go into denial. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, unprepared denial is a bad thing, but prepared denial is a healthy thing because if you really thought all the time about what the possibilities were and the seismic instability of the landscape, you'd drive yourself crazy and you wouldn't be able to live here. So I think there's always that negotiation that we do with ourselves here or that anybody does any place where there's extreme weather or extreme natural conditions, et cetera, where you have to or else you wouldn't be able to just go about your business.
Okay, so tell us a bit about how this earthquake mentality or the fascination with earthquakes has been captured in books that you like here in Los Angeles.
Well, I think there are a number. I mean, I think, in John Fonte's Ask the Dust, part of there's a scene that takes place in the immediate aftermath of a 1933 Long Beach earthquake where Arturo Bandini, who's Fonte's narrator and alter ego, thinks that it's actually divine retribution brought on him for having sinned, which is a particular favorite response. I always love the writer's self-centered view of the universe. So there's that. There's a great sort of avant-garde novel called Quake by a writer named Rudolf Wurlitzer, who became or went on to be a screenwriter, wrote Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, wrote Little Buddha. But this novel, it begins at the Tropicana Hotel in Hollywood. There's a huge earthquake And then we kind of follow the main character through a really desolated, destroyed Los Angeles, a really sort of, you know, almost Pynchon-esque apocalyptic black comic landscape. That's a book I have a lot of admiration for. But the writer who I think really captures it the most fully is Carrie McWilliams, as I think is true of many things about Southern California. I think, you know, McWilliams really, really got it. He wrote an essay in the 30s about earthquake myths, where he basically said at the end of the essay, he says that the way that we respond to the word earthquake depends on what kind of earthquake we've been through. Mm-hmm. And that if you've been through an earthquake like this morning's, which actually, I mean, at the risk of sounding crazy, was kind of fun, right? I mean, it was...
Well, when it was over.
I actually kind of even enjoyed it while it was going on. I mean, it, you know, as my friend Carolyn Kellogg said at the Times jacket copy at the book block today, you know, it was time to get up. So it was very considerate in that way. It could have been at 3:30 in the morning. But it was a jolt. It was big enough that it really asserted itself. You know, it made us aware of it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, no major damage, city function, no power loss, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it was over quickly. And you know, so there is something sort of exciting and thrilling, I think, about being in touch with the elemental nature of the universe. And that's what McWilliams is talking about. If you've been through one like that, it, you know, you have that sense, oh, this is kind of fun. If you've been through a big one like Northridge,
yeah,
or Long Beach, you're much more trepidatious.
All right, David Yulin, book critic for the LA Times, author of the book The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Predictions, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. It's been really fun this morning. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Actually, this afternoon. It was fun this morning with the earthquake. Anyway, social. So if you'd like to reach us and talk about your fears and fantasies about earthquakes, you can do so. You can leave us an email at pressplay@kcrw.com. Leave us a comment on our Facebook page or Twitter at @KCRW Press Play. All right. Waiting patiently. Warren Allnay and To the Point. Coming up at 1, do you find earthquakes fun?
I think trepidatious is
probably
a good word. I appreciated
side.
Hearing that. It's a wonderful word. I don't know if there's earthquake country in Crimea or Ukraine or not, but I wouldn't be in a state of denial in either one of those places. We're going to talk about those on To the Point today. In the aftermath of the vote yesterday, and of course the big question is, what will Putin do next? He's going to address the Duma, the Russian parliament, tomorrow. And we'll look at what his options might be, including from a very interesting Russian gentleman who has that point of view.
Okay. Looking forward to the interesting Russian gentleman.
Very, very good.
Coming up
very
at 1 o'clock on To the Point, Warren Allnay. Thank you for that.
Okay.
And on this show, right before that, we're going to talk about the slow but steady progress on preservation in Los Angeles. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Residents of Long Beach and fans of the giant donut sign there celebrated a victory a couple months ago. They were able to save the big donut from the wrecking ball. But as any Angelino knows, so many other landmarks in our area have not been as lucky. LA County has a really bad reputation when it comes to preserving historic buildings, and that's exactly what the LA Conservancy is trying to change. The nonprofit just released its latest report card ranking local communities on their preservation efforts. Adrian Fine is director of advocacy for the Conservancy, and he joins us now with the headlines. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Well, one headline is Beverly Hills. They got an F on your last report card, and now they get an A. What happened?
A lot of good things happened. Beverly Hills went from a place where preservation was not heard of at all, really, in terms of being followed or adhered. And really, in less than 2 years, they passed an ordinance, are currently doing a survey, put in place a cultural heritage commission, and have really taken preservation seriously. They still have a ways to go, but it's probably the most dramatic of any community going from having nothing to having something really strong in place.
And yet you have a lot of F's, too. Many more F's than A's.
Absolutely. We have more than 50 communities in Los Angeles County have no preservation tools or policies in place at all, which is something that we hope that this report card will get their attention and that they'll really see this as an opportunity to think about how they can improve and start putting things in place.
So just looking at your list under the F's, you have Vernon sharing an F with La Cañada Flint Ridge or Malibu. Also on that same list. So is it more about the policies in place rather than the historic significance of the buildings?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is really looking at zeroing in on whether a city has put in place a preservation ordinance or not, and then do they have incentives like the Mills Act and things like that. So you can have a city that may have amazing historic places, but have no tools whatsoever to try to ensure that they're protected or preserved in the future.
But this costs a lot of money, and places like Vernon, which don't have a lot of money, can't afford to do so?
It shouldn't have to at all. A lot of cities, it's essentially passing a policy, and how you choose to implement that. A lot of cities don't have any staff whatsoever. That's not what we recommend, but cities start usually, especially smaller cities, you know, just by implementing an ordinance, putting in place a cultural heritage commission, and going from there. So this doesn't need to be something that equates to a large budget item in order to have preservation in place as part of your city.
So what's holding them back?
I think some cities think they don't have anything worth preserving, which is a misnomer. Every city has something that's important that defines their heritage and their community character. Some cities are more reluctant because they believe the myths or misconceptions about what preservation is or isn't. It's not about stopping change. It's about allowing for growth and development to occur, but to balance that with the need to preserve your community character in the same process. So I think it's reasons like that. And then we also found in doing this report that some cities, I think, held back or declined in terms of their effectiveness because of the recession. Either they let staff go or they didn't prioritize this as they might have when times were good.
Well, I want to bring up one example that's happening right now. And the MTA is about to demolish two buildings on the corner of First and Alameda to make room for the Gold Line. And the buildings themselves aren't architecturally significant, but they are historically significant, at least to some people. Senor Fish is there now, and it's leaving. And then before that, it was home to the Atomic Cafe, where musicians and artists would hang out, including a young Beck. And so I'm wondering how you at the Conservancy distinguish between architecturally significant buildings and historically significant buildings.
It's a really good point. It's something that we're focusing on more and more, that there are a lot of places out there in Los Angeles and throughout the county that are very rich in cultural, social history, but looking at the building, it may not look like it's all that important because it doesn't have a lot of architectural distinction, and that's exactly the case with Atomic Cafe, that it's a nice red brick, you know, kind of early commercial building, but the real story there is what happened there and the people that took part there and the kind of the early punk development of Los Angeles when it was Atomic Cafe and later on. So, you know, that level of the story is a harder story to tell because people usually just want to see and look at a building and understand it based on, you know, its looks only. But sometimes you have to dig deeper. So we're working on lots of sites that involve cultural significance.
And would you go to bat for something like that or just say, look, you know, this is the price of progress?
No, absolutely. We worked very closely with locals in the community trying to save Atomic Cafe and figuring out if there was an alternative, including there was an effort looking at trying to realign the subway line there, or if that couldn't happen, looking at moving the Atomic Cafe or Senor Fish as it's known today. Those efforts were explored. So absolutely. A historic landmark doesn't have to be just a building that is significant for its architecture, but also about what it's about and who's connected to that place and the stories that building can tell.
Adrian Fine, Director of Advocacy for the Los Angeles Conservancy, which has issued its report out today, its preservation report card for Los Angeles County for 2014. Adrian, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jolie Meyer Harris is here. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. And I, like a lot of people, started my Monday shaking in my bed. I was trying to peel myself out of bed. My alarm was going off at the very moment, and so I took it as a sign. It was time to get up.
That's amazing. It's like when your iPhone shakes and you're...
Right, I thought
I was getting a call at the same time.
It's I thought it was the vibrating version. Part of the alarm at first, and I was like, it's a little bit big for that. So I went to Twitter and I wanted to know if you all had any non-traditional items in your earthquake kits. Are all things considered anchor Steve Chiatakis weighed in? He says he keeps a pair of fresh socks in his kit.
Just in case.
Just in case, I bet his mom is proud. Andy King on Twitter keeps iodine, a space blanket, and duct tape. I considered Googling space blanket, but decided my imagination could do a better job filling in the blanks. Tweet us with your items at KCRW Press Play. Over on Facebook, Brian Forney says the Van Nuys Fresh and Easy is going to need a cleanup on aisle 6. There were apparently broken bottles and boxes strewn all over the floor. We had a lot of people sharing their stories. Where were you when the Tumblr hit? Adam Clare says, everybody calm down. It was only a 4.4, so go back to work or yoga or writing a screenplay at Starbucks or grooming your ironic facial hair or doing more yoga and or being a, quote, producer. Someone's just grumpy that he had to get up at 6:25 this morning, I
think. Instead of sleeping in.
Instead of sleeping in.
Before his yoga class. All right. Well, thank you to Julie Myers, our very productive producer. Mm. Not in air quotes. You are.
Well, thank you.
All right. That'll do it for us today. Warren Olney up next with To The Point. You can always contact us. Email pressplay@kcrw.com. We're on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I am as well at The Mad Brand. Facebook, voicemail. Oh, we have it all. Just get in touch if you'd like. We'd love to hear from you. Warren Olney, as I said, is up next. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.